Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 3rd, 2014. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, the mad fermentationist Michael Tonsmeyer joins us to talk about his new book on brewing American sour beers, and we walk around club night at the National Homebrewers Conference to find tasty examples of sour homebrew and talk to the brewers who made them. If you're new to home brewing or would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james, and our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on the Google Plus, too. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site, especially in our absence, despite the fact that we took the month of June off. You were still clicking, and we greatly appreciate that. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, go to our website first, basicbrewing.com. Click on our ad. That will take you back to Amazon, where you can purchase stuff. It won't cost you any extra, and we will get a cut of what you purchase. We greatly appreciate the support there. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes and our Android app on Amazon.com. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app as well. We're on the Windows Phone directory, too. We're just everywhere. Check out our Brewer's Logbook at BasicBrewingShop.com. In the front is a blank calendar that you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews. And there is room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of brew. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. Thanks to everybody who has done so already. Protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. Check those out at basicbrewingshop.com. And finally, our Basic Brewing bottle openers are in stock and heading out the door. For a limited time, you can get a free opener with the purchase of any of our DVD combos. So, quite the deal. June went by very quickly, as it always does. It was a very productive month, and there was some quality family time thrown in there, too. Before the break, I promised to get back to reading email. So, now that we're back, let's jump around and just let us fulfill that promise. Ken from Newnan, Georgia writes, I have brewed about a dozen partial mash batches, and my next batch will be all grain. I read in How to Brew by John Palmer, Chapter 19, to add the strike water to the grain a bit at a time instead of adding the grain to the water so as not to thermally shock the enzymes. What do you think and recommend? I've watched on some of your videos that you add the grain to the water while stirring to avoid dough balls, and this is what I've been doing with my partial mashing. Well, I'm sure if John Palmer recommends something, it is probably best practice. But sometimes something that is not best practice works pretty well. I don't remember if I've ever actually tried adding water to the grain. For me, adding grain to the water is an easy way for me to hit my target strike and mash rest temperatures in the mash tun and or kettle if I'm doing brew in a bag. And I've never had any problems with the enzymes not working or not converting those starches into sugar. However, it only takes me about 2 minutes to mix my grain into the water for a 5-gallon batch, say. So I don't think that short time period is going to make a huge impact on the effectiveness of the enzymes. But if you're brewing a much larger batch and it's going to take you a long time to mix the grain into the strike water, your mileage may vary. So I say try it both ways and see what you like. I like adding grain to the water. It's always worked for me. But, you know, there are probably people out there who add the grain and the water at the same time to the mash tun. I've seen that done as well. So, if you're listening and have feedback on any differences you've found from adding water to the grain and vice versa, drop me a line and let me know what you think. We have a sponsor this week. You know that Basic Brewing Radio is one great way to stay in touch with all things home brewing. Another great way to learn more about brewing better beer, joining the American Homebrewers Association. More than 43,000 members rely on the AHA for great benefits like events, web resources, Zymergy magazine, and money-saving AHA member deals. As a not-for-profit organization, the AHA relies on members to support their work to promote, protect, and grow the homebrewing hobby. Whether you're an expert homebrewer or just getting started, visit homebrewersassociation.org to join today. We had a great time at the National Homebrewers Conference in Grand Rapids, speaking of the American Homebrewers Association. We recorded 8 audio episodes and 2 video episodes. All of it is excellent material, of course. Thanks very much to everybody who shared experiments with us and or knowledge, and of course, excellent homebrew. Also, I want to thank everybody who attended my session on small batch brewing. Some people actually showed up, good amount of people, and asked good questions at the end. Seemed like they were paying attention, which was always good. A lot of fun to do that. And it was fun also to see people in person that we only communicate with online. But unfortunately, we only got to spend a short amount of time with most of the people that we saw. About the only way that we found to spend time with people was to schedule an interview. Mike Tonsmeyer was a very popular guy at the conference, and I don't know if we would have met up if not for this recording time, because it seems like everybody wanted to talk to him. Mike's book, American Sour Beers, Innovative Techniques for Mixed Fermentations, sold out all the copies that they brought to the event, and it is justifiably so. It's a fun and very informative read. I met up with Mike at Club Night, where homebrew clubs across the country show off to the other homebrewers at the conference. And among those beers served were some very tasty sours. Mike Tonsmeyer, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Always a pleasure to be here, and in person in particular.
Welcome to my birthday party.
It's a big blowout, James.
Well, you know. You have written a book, and I have read most of that book. I was really impressed with it, of course, as I expected to be. It outlines the basics. It goes through and you talk about the different methods that different breweries take, and each one is different. Probably there's a reason. You wouldn't pick breweries that were doing it all the same. So there's like, what, a dozen breweries that you outline the different techniques that they
use? Yeah, 10 breweries and then 3 home brewers who, either one is me, of course, but then 2 who had won NHC Brewer of the Year in the last 5 or 10 years, Remy Bonart and Dave and Becky Pyle, who are close to me. They live in Northern Virginia and have always been terrific.
It really kind of demystifies, or at least it takes a lot of the mystery out of the topic, and that's a lot of the knowledge has been acquired just over the past few years, has it not?
I'm not sure the knowledge has been acquired over the last few years. The knowledge has been set free, shall we say. I think, as we all know, Belgian brewers, there are some who are very open, but many of them are very tight-lipped about, you know, and often can be deceptive. You know, they might tell you an answer, and it's not the right answer. It's intentionally not the whole answer. And I really didn't set out to write a book about American sour beers. I set out to write a book sort of recapping my first 5 years writing Mad Fermentationist, what my thoughts were, what my methods were. I thought, well, why not, you know, talk to a couple of brewers? I'm writing a couple of magazine articles. And they were just so amazingly open and willing to tell me basically anything I wanted to know, what sort of mash profile they used, what sort of microbes they pitched, temperatures, times, real specifics. And I sort of felt like it was my duty to pass these things on to the wider homebrewing audience.
We're standing outside Club Night here at the conference, and we're going to try something sort of like what we did at GABF a couple years ago. Go in and try to find some interesting sour beers and talk to some brewers. But before we go in there, I just want to pick your brain.
Sure.
If someone's listening to this and they've tasted sour beers and they love sour beers, but they've never brewed one.
Yep.
Start with some guidelines. I mean, first of all, let's start with some of the basics. What are the bugs that we're going to be working with?
Sure. So you're going to still be working generally with Saccharomyces, so brewer's yeast. You can use either an ale yeast or a lager yeast. There are certainly some techniques that skip brewer's yeast altogether. That really isn't the bulk of them. 100% Brett beers are really interesting. I have a chapter in the book on them, but they are separate from everything else. There's actually just some recently researched microbiology on Cantillon's process, where they figured out what microbes were at work in there spontaneously. Lager yeast showed up. Who knows? It's just all sorts of crazy things in there. New Belgium uses lager yeast, too. The other big sort of big players are Lactobacillus and Pediococcus. Those are lactic acid bacteria. They produce the lactic acid. They really are what make a beer sour. There's Brettanomyces, and this is sort of, I think a lot of people associate with sour beer. It doesn't produce acidity on its own. It's not going to make a sour beer simply with it and brewer's yeast, but it produces a lot of the fruity flavors, the hay, the farmyard, the horse blanket is the way a lot of people describe it, but sort of the funkier, weirder flavors that might go into a sour beer.
And Brett also works in conjunction with other organisms.
Yeah, so Pediococcus in particular, if you just pitch Pediococcus along with brewer's yeast, it's going to leave all these weird, unpleasant flavors behind. It's going to leave diacetyl behind. Mm. It might make the wort really viscous. It's almost like a snotty consistency. When brewers talk about beer being sick, often I'd heard it described as being ropey. Mm-hmm. Then we had a barrel that went sick, and it was like a stringy viscosity. Would dip the sample thief in, and it would come out, and a string would attach down to the beer. And these are, they're actually called exopolysaccharides. So exo outside, poly, many, saccharide, sugar. So just long sugar chains that the Pediococcus produces, the Brettanomyces will eventually break down. And some brewers claim that this is actually sort of a key step. Russian River, Cantillon, some of the best sour beers in the world get sick. Then there are other brewers who say, oh, there's, you know, there's something wrong if your beer gets sick. That's not something you want. And that's, I think, what you were sort of alluding to. There's a lot of answers to most of these questions. The book is not, here's the right way to do it. It's, hey, if you like Cascade brewing up in Portland, Oregon, here's what they do. They use Lactobacillus. They don't pitch Brettanomyces. They don't like that funky flavor. They layer on fruit flavors and barrel flavors and spice flavors. On the other hand, there are other breweries that really focus. Ithaca Brewing in New York for Brut and Le Bleu. They're only pitching Brettanomyces. In the case of Le Bleu, there's some wild bacteria, wild lactic acid bacteria that gets in on the blueberries, but they're really focusing on those funkier flavors. Their beers aren't as sour. So there's no right answer. I think both those breweries produce fantastic beers. There's no right and wrong. It's personal preference.
Right. And you were saying that, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were saying, like, for instance, Peter Buchart has a little bit of a preference. Was it Acetobacter that he liked a little bit?
Yeah, he liked Acetobacter. He said in particular, well, you would never just pitch Acetobacter. Acetobacter makes vinegar, acetic acid. I'm not a big fan of acetic acid, but New Belgium's beers have a slightly sharper acidity, I think, than I want. It helps cut through some residual sweetness. The risk with Acetobacter is once you have acetic acid, Brettanomyces can combine it with ethanol, just alcohol that's, of course, in every beer, and make ethyl acetate. And this can be, just a little touch can be pear, it can be fruity, it can be very pleasant, but more than that, it becomes solvent, nail polish remover. To me, one of the least pleasant flavors. Acetobacter needs oxygen, though, and I go as far as I can out of my way to prevent oxygen from coming in contact with the fermenting, souring beer. If you do want a little bit of acetic acid, I'd make homemade vinegar. You can leave a little bit of the beer, say half a gallon, in a either an open mason jar, maybe in a growler with a little piece of cheesecloth, rubber banded over the top. Get that as vinegary, soury as you want. You could blend it into taste right at bottling. Save the rest for making sauerbraten or sauerkraut or homemade salad dressing or mustard or whatever you want. You might not need it all. You might not need any of it.
Let's talk about wort production.
Mm-hmm.
What have you got to think of when you're creating a wort for a sour beer?
There's some breweries out there, some home brewers, that literally will just split a 10-gallon batch, and they'll ferment 5 gallons of Kolsch with their European ale yeast, and they'll take the rest, and they'll pitch all their microbes and make a great sour beer. My presentation was on. I just wrote an article for Zymergy on all the sort of other tweaks you can do. So the easiest might be to mash a little bit hotter, to mash at 157, 158, 159. That will produce more dextrins. We always call those unfermentables, but they're really only unfermentable to brewer's yeast. Brewer's yeast, about 3 glucose molecules, maltotriose, is as long as they can, as big a sugar as they can ferment. Brettanomyces, lactobacillus, strain-dependent, almost all Brettanomyces, some lactobacillus, can ferment dextrins up to 9 glucose molecules long, so 3 times longer. In the case of Brettanomyces, I really, if you're just making a funky beer, if you want to make something more like a Reval, I don't think there's much benefit to mashing hot, to making a lot of unfermentables. A lot of Brettanomyces character is from phenols, so having a spicy primary yeast, maybe doing a furulic acid rest about 113 Fahrenheit. That's going to get most of Brett's character. If you want sourness, though, that's really where you need the unfermentables. You need a strain of lactobacillus or pediococcus that can chew through those, make lactic acid. Other things to consider, wort pH, that's a big issue. pH is a logarithmic scale, so, you know, mash pH is around 5. Finished beer is around 4 for sort of a clean beer. Most sour beers are down in the 3s. So a sour beer is going to have 100 times more acid in it than the wort pre-fermentation. So that's a lot of acid. So where you have to worry about pH is things like if you're doing a spontaneous fermentation, so like a lambic fermentation. We always say as homebrewers, you know, it's the classic line, homebrewers, you can't get sick, nothing that is human pathogenic can grow in wort. The caveat that no one ever says is if you pitch brewer's yeast. When you just have wort, E. coli, salmonella, all sorts of really nasty stuff can grow in there. By adding just a little bit of lactic acid, a little bit of acid malt, getting the pH down to 4.4 around there, you'll stop the reproduction of those nasty microbes. The problem is that that's actually not the way lambic has been traditionally made, and some lambic brewers claim that allowing those nasty microbes to get in there, well, they're going to be dead 2 years before you're drinking the beer. They might release enzymes. They might release fatty acids that get turned into delicious esters. The only sort of issue there, and you certainly can skip that, there are some people who are allergic to compounds called biogenic amines. People have a histamine reaction to them. Not everyone, in fact, not many people at all, but it is something to be aware of if you tend to be the sort of person who has a lot of allergic reactions. I would be extra careful. If you're a commercial brewer and you want to, you know, if there's going to be 10,000 people drinking your beer and you want to make sure that 10 of them don't have a bad allergic reaction, it'll also produce a cleaner beer. It won't be as weird and funky and crazy. At the very least, if you're doing a spontaneous fermentation, if you don't lower the pH, I would skip tasting the beer until it really starts fermenting. You know, don't taste the wort after 2 or 3 days. Let the pH get down into the 4s. Let there be a couple of points of alcohol, something like that. Wort production is really interesting, but it doesn't have to be intimidating. You can just do a relatively basic beer, not too strong, not too hoppy, not too dark. A Belgian wit would make a great sour beer, a Saison, an English brown, a Scottish 60 Schilling, an American blonde ale. Any of those could be a great base for a sour beer.
And speaking of a spontaneous fermentation, you were saying that the lambic breweries, say that they're doing spontaneous fermentation, but a lot of the work is done by bugs that are in the barrels.
I look at a lot like seed saving. I mean, seed savers, you're not doing genetic manipulation, but by simply taking the barrels, in this case, that produce the best beer. And if a barrel makes a beer that tastes like nail polish remover or tastes like mold, Cantillon burns them. They get rid of them. If you get new barrels, you might say you've got 10 great barrels and you want 10 new barrels, you might take a scoop of lambic out of each of those, maybe some of the slurry from the bomb, add it to the fresh barrels. In those cases, fresh barrels, you know, well-used Pilsner barrels, wine barrels, cognac barrels, to sort of pass on your favorite microbes to the next generation. 5 years later, you want to start 10 more barrels? Now you pick, your new favorite 5. And you keep doing that, and they've been doing it for decades, in some cases centuries, and you end up with your own house culture. It's still spontaneous fermentation. They've never pitched anything in there.
Right.
But it's, in some ways, a very carefully selected house culture. And particularly when you add into that blending, if a barrel tastes off, there's a lot less variability than simply setting your word out overnight and putting it into a sterile carboy. That's actually a very different thing. In some ways, that's probably how they started a long time ago. But even their old stories about lambic brewers, you know, they open a new cool ship and they take an old bottle of Goose and they spray it on the walls or on the ceiling. I know Algash did something like that for their cool ship. But they've had fantastic results, and I think that's a cool thing that a lot of these American breweries, whether it be Jolly Pumpkin or Algash or Russian River or Jester King, have been doing spontaneous fermentations. I did one in my backyard in D.C. have had terrific results and surprisingly lambic-like results. That these microbes, you know, you're certainly your first batch, and particularly unblended, isn't going to taste like Driefontein and Eau de Goose, but you're going to get some flavors that are reminiscent of it. You might get a little bit of hay, but you might be missing the fruit. You might get a little mineral character, but not have enough acidity. It really takes a commitment to doing those, a commitment that luckily normal sour beers don't necessarily take. When you're pitching selected microbes, either from a blend or from bottle dregs from your favorite unpasteurized sour beer, you can really get some fantastic, interesting flavors more reliably.
And you, the technique that you did, or you talk about in your book about your... And I kind of have an issue with the term spontaneous fermentation because it's not really spontaneous.
No.
It comes from bugs that are either in the air.
There is no spontaneous
right. You don't get mice
generation.
Don't get mice that come magically from the hay.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And maggots don't magically form in the beef.
Exactly.
But, you know, just to use as a term.
Yeah.
But you collected wild organisms from different places in your house and around your house and then selected those that tasted good.
Yeah. And I didn't go through. I actually, just this morning, I went to Jeff Mello, who runs bootlegbiology.com, who used to live very close to me in D.C. and hung out a couple of times. And he's given me a couple of cool yeast strains. He is streaking things out. He is swabbing things. I do a much more sort of simple, I'm just leaving word out, I'm letting something get in there, I'm not tasting it, I'm not touching it until fermentation gets going, I'm stepping it up. And then if there's weird looking mold on it or it smells real gross, I'm getting rid of it. But I'm pitching a mixed culture. I don't know what's in there. The beer ended up very lambic-like, but whether it's Pediococcus, Lactobacillus, and Brettanomyces or something else completely, I really don't know. You can also, local fruit's great. Jester King's been playing with wild flowers. You can swab things. You can isolate things. Or you can just sort of do this natural, hey, whatever's in there is in there. If the result of that first year's batch is good, you can take a scoop of that and pitch it into next year's batch and maybe start a new spontaneous one and then pick your favorite after that one and, you know, splice them out, try something. My friend Jamie was just telling me that now every time he brews, if he has an extra half gallon of wort, he'll stick it outside on a sheet pan, let it get going, put it into a growler. If it turns out great, cool. You know, he recorded what time that, you know, when it was, what temperature it was. But now he also has a little starter that you can really taste what those microbes did. And if you want, you can repitch it, or you know, you just have a good data point that, okay, in my area...
Right,
the problem with sour beers, there's so much variability, though, that you could put two sheet pans out right next to each other, pour them into two different growlers on the same night, same wort, and you might get two completely different beers. And that's sort of the tricky thing with sour beers is they're never going to be as consistent as you're used to with brewer's yeast.
And it takes time. It takes time for flavors to develop, and you can't just check it a week later and see what that's going to do.
Well, it's weird. Like my spontaneous fermentation, a month in, It tastes like a tropical Hefeweizen. It was pineapple and clove. And the weird thing was that Gabe Fletcher up at Anchorage Brewing, he said he tried spontaneous fermentation up there, and a month in, he had the same flavors.
Huh.
I mean, it's just this weird, and then, but both of us, you know, the flavor really radically changed over time as new microbes got woken up and took over the fermentation and changed it, and, you know, everything went off in our own direction. But I think a lot of these microbes, it's more about your process than about where you are. And I don't think, you know, I don't buy the, you know, you've got to be next to a cherry orchard or you have to be. If you've ever seen Cantillon, it's in a pretty industrial, pretty urban district. It's not that sort of beautiful, you know, farmland that's on the labels. I think that, you know, goes a long way to saying that a lot of these microbes are in the barrels, they're in the wood. Jean Van Roy of Cantillon has talked about allowing the barrels to flow over during fermentation. The yeast dries, the krausen dries, and turns into sort of a yeasty dust that sort of blows around the whole brewery. getting in the cool ship, getting in everything else. And so it's, he's got his own little, you know, ecosystem, micro ecosystem in the brewery itself.
And we can take an easier way out, of course, and buy commercial bugs, and use the dregs from other sour beers that haven't been pasteurized.
Yeah.
So you don't have to do the tricky way.
Well, it's amazing how many new yeast labs are popping up everywhere. Down south, there's South Yeast. On the West Coast, there's the Yeast Bay. In Chicago, there's Omega Yeast. In the Southeast, there's Giga Yeast. There are a lot of home brewers who are doing these isolations that are sending people samples. Mm-hmm. It's gone from where there being maybe three or four different Bretts to choose from to 100. Hmm. I think really what's coming in the next 10 or 15 years, there's probably going to be 1,000 different Brettanomyces strains. Wow. It'll be figuring out what they're good for. I mean, it took people a while to figure out that Brettanomyces bruxellensis Dre or Twa, when it's sold by White Labs, is terrific as a primary fermentation agent. Hoppy beers in particular, it's bright, it's citrusy. It doesn't actually work that well when you pitch in secondary like you'd think, or Vol or something like that. It's okay. It's kind of bland. It's not really exciting. It's not that funky. I think that's going to be the trick, you know, figuring out which of these Brettanomyces are great in a big stout, which of them are great in, you know, a hoppy beer finishing, which are great in combination with another microbe. And that's where you guys, the homebrew listeners, are going to be so essential, because no brewery has the resources to try out 1,000 different beers. It's going to be people sharing on message boards and sending James Spencer samples of beer so that he can try them on the air. And,
yeah, that's a good idea.
and figuring out what works and what doesn't work, which of these strains are valuable. And not every strain of Brettanomyces will be good for anything. I mean, some of them are just going to be, sure, it's Brettanomyces. It makes, you know, it makes it taste like a Band-Aid. No matter what you do, don't use it. And hopefully over the next couple of years, not only will we have so many new strains, but we'll really learn as a community what they're good for, what they're not good for, that sort of thing.
And you also talk about sour mashing and sour worting. Is that what you...
The term I invented, yes.
So there are kind of shorter ways
Definitely.
To getting sour beers.
And Trinity Brewing out in Colorado has been doing some really... He does a beer, I think, called a 7-Day Sour. It's amazing. He does a quick souring with lactobacillus and then 100% Brettanomyces. So not only is he getting a quick amount of acidity, he's then getting some of the classic funkier, fruitier, more interesting flavors. I think it's... I had a GABF this last year. I thought it was just as good as most American breweries' long-age sour beers. It's bright, it's refreshing, it's wow. complex, it's interesting. He has a similar beer called Red Swingline that's has a bunch of hops added to the whirlpool, some citrus zest, some coriander, 4% alcohol, funky, hoppy, sour. It's like my dream beer. I mean, it's a session beer that is bright and refreshing, but also weird and interesting as you let it warm up. And he's figured out he's got a mix of Brettanomyces strains. He's got a lactobacillus that's really aggressive. There have been a lot of the commercial lacto strains I haven't had good luck with. Some of them just don't produce that much acidity. It's really weird. I did a beer with nothing but White Labs lactobacillus. 100%. It fermented, big krausen. Gravity dropped way down. It tastes like an American wheat. I'm happy White Labs just released lactobacillus brevis, which is a more aggressive, higher acid-producing strain. I'm excited to try that. It's a similar strain Cascade uses, lactobacillus brevis, too, for their beers. But that's sort of it. Lactobacillus you can get from anywhere. I've grown it from grain. I've bought probiotics at my local Whole Foods. I've used dregs from bottles. I mean, it's an interesting yeast. I'm sorry, it's bacteria. I'm going to start something. After I finally gotten everyone to stop saying Brettanomyces is a bacteria, it's a yeast.
That's true.
Lactobacillus, bacteria. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of the fun of this. You have all these different options on where to get microbes, when to add them, how to add them, what other flavors you want to combine with them. And there's a lot of really weird, interesting... I had a dry hop lambic in there tonight. I had a couple of different barrel-aged sour beers, a sour quad. You know, certainly some classic, you know, your lambics and your Flemish reds and your Ode Bruins and your Bonneau Weisses, but a lot of people were doing 100% Brett pale ales. There was a table that had, I think, five different 100% Brett beers with different strains of Brettanomyces in each one. Fun to try a whole bunch of those next to each other and see, you know, really what each of those has their own character. And Brettanomyces is just like ale yeast. Sierra Nevada uses ale yeast. Saison DuPont uses ale yeast. They don't taste anything alike.
Yeah.
Just because you have two Brettanomyces bruxellensises doesn't mean that they're going to taste anything alike. They have bigger genomes than Saccharomyces. They're going to have a huge range of flavors.
Well, speaking of the beers that are in there, shall we take a walk and see what we can find?
Yeah, definitely.
We'll pause for a second, and then we'll find something fun and tasty, and we'll be right back.
Cool.
Okay, first of all, introduce yourself.
Chris Carr, Muskegon Ottawa Brewers.
And what are we drinking here?
This is a Solera Barrel Sour.
Talk about the process.
Process started out with a spent Dragon's Milk barrel from New Holland. We started out with a 50-50 wheat, two-row base, 3.5%, 10 IBUs roughly. Progressively over the next 4 years, we did 15 gallons out, 15 gallons in, 100% fermented in the barrel. Every time we rebrewed for it, it was roughly 1% higher in alcohol and about 5 SRM darker. The last batch that went in, which you're tasting now, the last batch was about 60% Munich, 20% Special B, 20% dark candy sugar.
I was going to say, it's a beautiful red color. I mean, it looks right in that Flemish red, Oud Bruin range. And when you were saying, oh, it's 50% wheat, 50%, you know, I was like, oh, you sure about that? So what's the plan from here? Obviously you can't keep going darker and more alcohol forever. Does the project end, or does it, you know, do you wean it back the other way?
This is it. This project has ended. This is the last pull. It was a complete drain, and the barrel has already been refilled with a similar wort to start with.
What was your souring technique?
Souring technique, a lot of it relied on dregs from commercial brewers. I got some great yeast cultures from Jason Yester of Trinity Brewing in Colorado Springs. My friend was actually the taproom manager. She was local to me and just moved out there on a whim. So we got some great stuff from Jason.
I was actually just talking up Trinity Brewing like 5 minutes ago in the little intro to this. They do some really cool stuff.
So what's did you get any inspiration for another style of beer, or what's your next sour project?
Our next sour project is, it's kind of hard to pinpoint where we'll go and what the barrel's going to give us. We're looking to get into a couple wine barrels. I'm actually with a professional brewery now. So eventually we hope to get Pigeon Hill on the map with a couple good sours.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, it's really nice. I get a little of that bourbony, chocolatey something coming through, but I think it goes really well with the dark red fruit. The acidity is, it's sour, but it's not vinegary. It's not overly sharp. It's really balanced and rounded.
Thank you.
Super pleasant.
That's what we're going for.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for bringing it. Thanks for sharing it.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, introduce yourself.
I'm Kyle Cole Morgan. I'm from the STL Hops Homebrew Club in St. Louis.
What do we got here?
This is a Goose, a blend of 2012 and 2013, like golden sour, lambic-esque, if you want to call it. Turbine mash, 50 wheat, 50 pilsner.
Phenomenal head retention for a sour beer.
Well, thank you.
That's amazing.
The 2012, I just aged in a bucket, and I racked the 2012 out the same day I brewed and put in the 2013, so I just kind of kept it going in a bucket. So I call it the homebrew horny tank. I just moved to St. Louis, so I had to cut it off, but I'd like to do it 3 or 4 years in a row to kind of get a good idea of what happens as you know, I have a few different ways. I call it do cold stream methods, and so that's one way I kind of keep stuff going.
What did you start with initially before you started repitching?
I took the dregs of a Flanders Red, the Rosarero brand. That was the primary pitch. It was an old blend, so it probably didn't have much sack left in it. Just a lot of Brett and lacto and BDO. And I don't just swirl the dregs and put them back in. I kind of culture them up a little bit in the bottle first. So some Russian River and then some Jolly Pumpkin, things like that. And then a guy that does runs a homebrew or a homebrew biology blog. I think it's BK Yeast. He isolated some Cantillon dregs. That's like the Lambic cheater code. Like, you know, that was really good stuff too. So I put that in there as well.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it tastes like a lambic. It's very lemony, bright, acidic, but not vinegary or sharp. I've always been I'm hesitant on buckets. I always worry that seal on that lid, if that isn't perfect and you're letting oxygen in there.
Yeah, I mean, like, most of my buckets, like, you can't really see it bubble anymore because it's broken. But, like, I try to use a fresher bucket, and it's only in there for, like, because I have so much, the culture, I'll start the culture up, so it's only in there, like, 8 months. So I toned down the acetic pretty good. If it's in there longer than a year, I'm not really sure about it. I've never done it that long. But, it's just that long, it's fine. So
this is delicious. It's bright and tart, but there's a little bit of an earthy background to it.
Yeah, I mean, I get a little toastiness, too. I don't know if it's yeast or if it's oak or if it's the malt or what's causing that.
On all my, like, I have a mother, like, mixed culture. I've kept over the years, and every one of the sour beers has this like nutty hazelnut flavor, but it's like pills and wheat, so I know it's yeast driven. I don't know where it came from, but it's there. And what I like about keeping that culture going is that I get that flavor in every one of those beers. It's, you know, it's one of the, you know, dominating flavors. Yeah, house flavor. It's great.
How do you take care of that culture?
Well, I haven't taken really good care of it in the last year. I just moved, right? But
ideally,
I have it in a gallon jug, and I'll feed it 6 or 8 months. A week or two before I go to brew, I'll feed it again. It'll kind of start bubbling.
Do you pitch any brewer's yeast in addition to that, or is it just 100% house culture?
The 2013 was 100% house culture. That was like the best year I've had so far. I don't think you really need Saccharomyces, you know, if you have enough, you know, different
regulations. That's something that's going to get going relatively quickly. You don't want it sitting there with half-dead bugs that are 4 years old, but where you're feeding it and getting it going, I mean, that seems like a great way to do it.
And it goes through some phases where it's like, it's not quite like underpitched yeast flavors, but, you know, you have to really, you know, four weeks in, there's some weird flavors that kind of has to go through before it, you know. It gets to be where it is, but you know, so like, but 8 months is a long, you know, it's the longest I've done it. So,
do you think there could be some Saccharomyces in there in that mix?
I think I've destroyed all that. I mean, like the 2013 was by the strips was like 3.2 pH, so I just don't think much of it survives. You know, it's Saccharomyces doesn't, you know, it's not as body as Brett. So I think that's all that's really left in there.
Well, this is delicious. Congratulations.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Dan Smith. I'm a brewer with the Bell City Home Brewers out of Racine, Wisconsin.
And what are we drinking?
Drinking a traditional, attempt at a traditional German Berliner Weiss.
Tell us about the process.
This is actually based off of the sour wort method, they call it. There's an article 2 years ago in Zymergy. I read it. I embraced it. I brewed it.
Wisconsin, I think,
yeah,
too.
Madison. Yeah. Never met the guy, but I've taken his recipe and I've had real good luck with it, or his base style, which is brewing your own sour culture, which I think really promotes you get a really strong lactic out of a yeast or out of grain cultures. As long as some PDO, which you won't get out of a, you know, production culture, you get a little complexity in your final sour product. I brew them to turn them around fast, so this is only 2 weeks old. I will cheat. I do add a little lactic acid in the end to get it to the tartness I want, but that's only a half an ounce of lactic in 5 gallons. So it's not a lot, but with all that natural souring complexity, you can use lactic and not get that chemical flavor, which, you know, you'll get a lot of...
What sort of estuary thing are you using? What sort of ale yeast are you using?
This is actually a blend of CBC01 and US05, but it was so acidic that I had to warm it up to get that yeast to go at all, right? Because, you know, it's like 10, 19 when I pitched the yeast, and it just stalled, right? It's so acidic at that point. So I warmed it up to get the yeast to take off, So you may get a little ester from that.
Is this sour mash beer?
Sour wort. I do a standard mash. I mash out. I boil to kill anything crazy there. And then I pitch this controlled sour wort starter.
Grain is the source of the lacto?
Right.
Whatever's on there.
Right, yeah, whatever's on there, but I get it below 4.5, right, to kill all the nasty stuff. I pitch that, I keep it at 100 for a few more days to get that natural sour, and then I reboil so I can run it.
Acidity on the wort.
Right, so then I can run it through my clean equipment and not be wrecking everything I own with crazy stuff. And actually, I don't even bother with the hops.
Completely unhopped. What's the point?
Right. I mean, it's in there for Reinheit's boot, right? It's nothing about the flavor.
But in America, you legally have to have a certain amount of hops for commercial beer, too.
Well, I'm not commercial, so I'll do what I want.
It doesn't matter.
Right.
It's weird in America, it's something like Kasake doesn't have hops, and so according to the TTB, it's a wine. According to the IRS, it's a beer. And they're weird things.
Yep. Sure.
As homers, we do whatever the hell we want.
That's right.
So this may be the first beer that I've tasted that doesn't have either hops or spices of like a gruit or something. This is just wort, grain and water and yeast, right?
Right. I mean, when I did them early on, I put hops in, and then a couple batches ago, I forgot. After the beer turned, I'm like, why am I using the hops?
Right? I agree. I mean, when you're talking about hops and you're talking about Berliner Weiss, you're often 3 IBUs, 4 IBUs, and that's a third of what Budweiser has, and Budweiser isn't exactly a highly bittered beer. I mean, and really all hops are preserving against is lactobacillus, and you're trying to get as much lactoactivity as you can.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
very nice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we wandered away and we came back to see Dan. Because what are we drinking now?
This is attempted at a traditional lambic, barrel-aged lambic. It's not a wild fermentation. We keep it airlocked, but, you know, we selected our original cultures, which is some East Coast, some Cantillon dregs, and some Jolly Pumpkin dregs to get the first stuff started. But really, I mean, this is all from what our guys from reading, you know, the bad fermentation on. You know, we started these barrels over 3 years ago. And, you know, they've been reading it for many years before that. And you know, that's inspiration to make absolutely fantastic homebrewed sour beers.
And so this is a group project that 13 people?
13 guys that get together every 6 months. And we brew, you know, 60 gallons of wort to refill. We pull half out of each barrel, and then we refill them. So we keep a really live, active fermentation in there. You know, some people don't blend them. Others of us blend the two barrels together. What you're drinking now is a single barrel, because we did decide one barrel had developed characters we didn't want. So next time we brew, we're actually going to bring in a new barrel. And instead of taking it out, half the wort from the good barrel's going in, and we're going to refill them both. Right, to try to keep a good culture. But still, both barrels are going to create their own beer in the end.
You'll have more oak in the new barrel, I assume. Wine barrels? Local wine barrels? Spirit barrels?
We had a Zinfandel barrel, and then a bourbon barrel the first time. I think we actually used the Zinfandel barrel that we had to toss. It went dry, or, you know, it was a straight up and down barrel. It sit vertical. And those top staves just went dry, where the horizontal barrels seem to last a lot longer, remove the moisture, or, you know, stay good.
So the other barrel was up on its end, you're saying?
Right.
I think it's hard, because as soon as you get a little evaporation, the whole top is exposed.
We even tried beeswaxing it to keep it sealed, but man, it just helped.
Oh, turn the lights off.
Oh, that sound is the lights are dimming.
10:58 already.
Wow, how did that happen?
Yeah.
This is sound of unhappy people.
What a homebrew left that's going to be going home in 2/3 drank kegs.
Well, Dan, thanks a lot again.
Thanks again.
And Mike, Here we are at the end. We are.
This is it, James. This is the end.
This is the end. We are all soured up.
This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing this.
Oh, of course. I mean, it's so cool to do this at GABF. Taste the cool things the commercial brewers are doing, but then realize homebrewers are doing the same sorts of interesting things. In some cases, things that commercial brewers can't get away with because, as we're hearing, you have to add hops legally to commercial beer. As a homebrewer, you can do whatever you want. You can add interesting ingredients. You can blend in wines or spirits. You can do things that aren't commercially viable, you know, you might not be able to sell for $25 a bottle to justify the expense or...
Yeah, you can screw things up and not cheese off your investors or whatever.
You might cheese off your family members or your spouse or your roommates or other people. You might make your house smell a little bad, or you might, you know, dump some wort on your garage floor or something, but you won't get hostile takeover by angry investors.
Well, it's really nice to see people respond to you. You know, we're walking around and introducing you around. People don't know what you look like, and then when they say, "Oh my God, that's all my," and so you can be incognito walking around and. And it's nice to see people responding to who you are and what you've done. And congratulations again on the book. And,
yeah, you talk modestly. Certainly no one came up and went, "Oh, it's the basic brewing guy. Oh, my God."
I put my ugly mug out there, so.
People see you. That's true.
Oh, but this has been a lot of fun, and I can't wait till we get together again.
Yeah, definitely. This is always fun. I mean, I think we've been doing this, for 7 years now? So.
Oh, my God.
You've been doing this for 8 years?
July of 2005. So, sneaking up on 9 years. Ninth birthday is.
And actually, I think it might be sneaking up on 8 years that I've been doing this, because I think it was 2006.
Wow. Well, it's been a productive and fun
good
and happy relationship.
Yeah.
So cheers.
Thanks again to Mike, and congratulations again on the book. I looked back in our archives and found that Tonsmeyer's first appearance on our show was in September of 2006. It's hard to believe it's been that long. Of course, you can buy his book and check out his blog, themadfermentationist.com, where you can find good info on sour brewing along with all kinds of different fermented foods and beverages. It's amazing the amount of stuff that is on that site. If you have brewing questions that I can answer, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You'll find our new bottle openers on our shop. Our Basic Brewing Growler bags are available. Protect your precious homebrew and craft beers. You take it from place to place. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping Into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, with a free bottle opener included with any DVD combo that you find on our shop. And you can check out our shirts as well, too. Our brewers' logbooks are on the store, too. Keep track of up to 50 batches of beer. See a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. Even though we were absent in June, we greatly appreciate the support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Intarsia Woodworking for Beginners. Skill Building Lessons for Creating Beautiful Wood Mosaics. 25 Skill Building Projects. And Stretch Out Strap with New Instructional Booklet. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, my buddy. So long.